Baruchim Abayim Rabotai. Welcome to a special edition of our Wednesday night class. Today, with your permission, I'd like to focus on one aspect of the parasha, which, although in practice doesn't apply today, but in theory has great applications. Our parasha discusses the law of a sota. What is a sota? Sota is a lady that her husband warned her very strongly with witnesses that he does not want her being alone with a certain man. The husband has a suspicion. He sees his wife acting in an immodest way, and therefore he wants to protect his wife, protect himself. So therefore he gives her an official warning. I do not want you to be alone with such a man. Subsequently, two witnesses come to the court, to the Jewish court, and say, we saw this lady secluded with that man. We don't know what they were doing. We just know they walked into a room, they closed the door. They could have been playing toilet for all we know. We have no idea what took place. But because we don't know what took place, so now the husband is obligated to take his wife to the Beit HaMikdash. And there's only one being besides the parties themselves that know what happened, and that's God. So the lady goes to the Beit HaMikdash, and she must drink special waters. These waters are called mesota. And if she indeed is guilty, and she did commit, God forbid, an act of adultery, then those waters become like a poison in her system, and she begins to explode. And she explodes. She blows up in front of the Beit HaMikdash. So it's an unbelievable thing. If she's innocent, so then the waters do not harm. On the contrary, it says the waters go in like a medicine and they give her a cure. It should be pointed out, regardless whether she committed a crime behind those closed doors or not, ethically this lady is guilty, no matter what she did. Even if it was an innocent game of chess or backgammon, but your husband said, don't seclude yourself with such a man. So you're right, you didn't go all the way to commit adultery, but there's levels of adultery. So the fact that you went in and you were warned and you said, that's guilt enough, you're immodest, it's not proper behavior. But it's not something that the Torah is going to blow a lady up because of. But it's guilty because of immodesty. The next story in the parasha is the story of a nazir. What is a nazir? A nazir is a fellow that makes a vow not to drink wine. His vow lasts for 30 days, and then after 30 days, halakha says he brings a sacrifice. He also lets his hair grow for 30 days. After the 30 days are up, he shaves his hair. That's called the law of a nazir. So the rabbis ask, why put the story of the sota lady and the story of the nazir man next to each other? Our Torah is so deep, we're allowed to ask that question. Not only are we allowed to ask, what does the parasha itself mean, but we're allowed and we're demanded to ask, why put them together? You see, in the New York Times, you can't ask that question. Why did they put the article on the top, and they put an article about President Bush on the top right column, and underneath it, they put an article about New York City Mayor Bloomberg. So you can't ask a question. What's the connection between the Mayor Bloomberg and President Bush? That's the New York Times. That has to do with an editor, and it has to do with space, and it has to do with positioning. In the Torah, however, if God decided to put these two stories together, there's a lesson in the connection. So listen to what the Gemara says. Gemara says, and I quote, Tanya, Rabbi Omer, Lama nismecha parashat nazir le parashat sota, lomar lecha, to teach you, shekol haro'eh sota bekelkula, yazir atzmo min hayayin. That anybody that sees the sota go through this process, he happened to be in the Beit HaMikdash that day. So they tell him, listen, you know, there's a situation of sota taking place. If you want to stand on the balcony, you can get to see the action. So he's unbelievable. There's sota in the Beit HaMikdash, drinking, explosions. So he stands on the gallery, and he's watching the process. And the Gemara says it's a very humiliating process to the lady. The Gemara says that they don't want her to drink the waters. They want her to confess. If she confesses, at least she remains alive. She can't go back to her husband, but at least she remains alive. So we try to intimidate, scare her, this, that. If she doesn't admit, they actually, Gemara says, they pull her head covering off. The modest ladies would cover their hair. So in order to embarrass her, they would rip her head covering off. They would make her wear, pull her clothes out so she would look like a mess. If she finally doesn't agree or confess, I'll drink. And she explodes, the Gemara says, somebody that saw such a thing happen, he should accept upon himself to become a Nazir. A man that witnessed such a scene, the next move, he should walk out of the Beit HaMikdash and say, I got to do something. What am I going to do? I'm going to become a Nazir, no wine for 30 days. So now the rabbis ask, why is that the reaction? It has to be a connection. Is that the normal reaction? I mean, it's definitely a spooky thing to see. You might want to go to a rabbi after to get a beracha so you don't have nightmares after what you saw. But to go accept upon yourself Nazir? So there's a few explanations that I'd like to share with you today. All applicable. The first explanation is like this. Human beings are very impressionable. And we are affected by what we hear, by what we see, by the surroundings that we're in. Environment, without a doubt, does affect the nature of a person. This man, yes, he saw a lady blow up. 95% of him says, wow, adultery, what a avon, I can't believe it. I mean, this man over here saw something that most people never see. A punishment from God on an adulterous lady. Definitely this man is fortified and strengthened. You know, if somebody's going to come and talk to this guy about adultery, he's going to say, oh, you don't know what it is. I was there. I saw the G blow up. It's unbelievable. Scariest thing I ever saw. It's wild. So this man definitely has an advantage in the fact that he saw the divine judgment. But he has a disadvantage also. The disadvantage he has is because he saw a lady that committed adultery. And the mere fact that he saw such a lady affects a person. Bar the punishment, we understand she got punished. But the fact that you walk in your brain now, you have a picture and you say, I don't believe this lady went and committed an act against her. Which means now in the mind of a person which is so impressionable, it now becomes a possibility. You saw it. It's not a great possibility, granted. It's still minute. And for sure, the fact that she blew up is going to be a greater influence than the fact that you saw her. But we cannot deny the facts. You did see something or a lady that's unethical, on the highest order. So in order to neutralize that effect of seeing something or a lady of such a nature, you have to accept upon yourself something. So in this case, he decides to accept upon himself not to drink wine. Why? Because if you think, what probably, this is theory, but in all likelihood, what probably got this lady in trouble? Drinking. What do I mean drinking? She probably went one night to a wedding, like we go every night, especially in this season, and there's an open bar, and we're social people, and we like to socially drink. It's proper. We have a drink in our hand at all times, whether it's a scotch or some wine, whatever it is. That's the problem. It's accepted. And you drink a little, and it's obvious when you start to drink a little, your mind becomes a little dull, and certain things that you wouldn't imagine saying when you were sober, now already you'll let yourself, you'll excuse yourself to say certain things or to act in a certain way or to behave and mood gestures, etc. So what probably got this lady in trouble in the beginning was she started to drink wine. But it was innocent. She saw a man at the wedding talking Aki Balash, like we say. But the next night at a Pidyon, and the next night at a Brit Milah, and then the morning at a Bar Mitzvah, and slowly, 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 and the draw was with a drink, always with a drink. So therefore, nobody's thinking really rationally. Nobody's thinking of their actions and their consequences, what's going to happen, what's going to be. So therefore, the Nazir says, unbelievable. The dangers of drinking, that's what probably got her into this whole mess over here. So to neutralize the negative thing that he saw, he accepts upon himself a vow of Nazirut. I don't have to tell you the opinion of the Chachamim, the way they looked at any addictions, whether it's drugs or alcohol. But the Rambam, who was known, of course, to be our greatest rabbi, but also was the greatest in medicine, was the greatest in psychology. He had every knowledge at his fingertips. And the Rambam, we consider in our community as the moderate opinion, the middle of the road, whatever that means. Listen to how Rambam's attitude on drinking. He writes, Ach ha-kibbutz ala shetiyah mishakeret. Those people that get together to drink in order to get drunk and to get high and to get a little tipsy, as they say, re'uya shiyeh etzlecha yoter herpa. You have to look at it more abominable. Mitkabetz anashim arumim migoleh ha'irva. And you'll forgive me, but I'm only reading the Rambam. He says it should be more abhorrent to you, more abominable than people getting together, unclothed, standing in a room, nifnim umatrizim, and they're defecating bebayit ahad. Now that's an extreme example. But let me explain you what Rambam meant. Rambam was saying, because what separates man from an animal? The only thing that separates man from an animal is his intellect, is his mind. Once a person's mind is shut off, is dulled, is muted, so therefore he's an animal, so therefore there's no difference. If you have a bunch of crazy people that have some type of weird idea in their mind that they're going to do what he said, they're going to go in the room and they're going to defecate, commit the craziest things. Now they're acting like fools. But all you need is somebody to walk into that room in 1 second and say, fellas, you guys are crazy. What are you doing? And you just kind of like snap them out of the trance. Boys, what's going on over here? And they say, you know what? The truth is, we're crazy. Where's all our clothes? What are we, crazy? We're temporary inside. Everybody get their clothes, go over there. You can snap them out of it. The intellect is there. It's just temporary shut off. But you can get them back. But go to a person that's drunk. Go to a person that's drinking, or he's on drugs. Tell the guy, what are you doing? He'll laugh at you. What am I doing? What are you doing? He won't take you seriously. On the contrary, he'll make you look like a fool. He'll embarrass you. He'll shame you. There's no way you can give rebuke or understanding to a person that's mind has been shut off. And this is what happened to that lady, unfortunately. She only got into that mess because she allowed herself to have that carefree life. It started small, but eventually it leads, as we said. The Torah is giving us another attitude here. Attitude number one is that we're influenced by what we see. You saw a lady commit adultery, that weakened your sense of ethics. Now you must do something in order to neutralize that negative thing that you saw. It should be pointed out and you'll forgive me. But if that's what the Torah is telling you, when you see a lady that's a sotah that blows up, that you need to do something, unfortunately today, whether it's in the movies or whether it's on television, adulterous behavior is considered quite normal and almost tolerable or acceptable. More than 50% of marriages in America have some form of this disease. And therefore, what does that do to us? What does that do to our marriages? What does that do to our brains when we're watching not an adulterer blow up? We're watching it glorified. We're watching it as a positive thing. We're watching it as a good thing, as something that's a taboo, something that's a forbidden fruit that already puts ideas in a person's mind. God forbid, and it won't lead to chas v'shalom, the sin itself. But why do we want to even put these ideas in our mind that can tempt a person even for a second to, God forbid, have the wrong thoughts? If a lady that blew up, you need to protect yourself from, all the more so when it's glorified. And you'll forgive me again. It's not my place to give rebukes, especially to this holy group that comes in. You know, I have the utmost admiration, specifically for all the ladies that come to this class. And that's the sad thing about coming to class, because whenever a rabbi delivers a rebuke or a word of musar, it's usually to the people that are not in class. So the people that are good, that came to class, that sacrificed themselves, so they have to bear the brunt of a rabbi's rebuke and say, "Rabbi, what are you yelling at me for? I'm the good person." And I understand that. And I felt the same way in yeshiva when our rabbis used to talk about all the things that were being done on the street. And we were thinking in our brains, when the rabbi is rebuking, "What are you talking to me for? I'm learning. I have to talk to the other guy. I'm not the problem." But there is a benefit anyway to mention these things. Unfortunately, there's a great sense of misjudgment or miscalculation that might be taking place by many people. There are many fads that come and go in a community. For example, golf 10 years ago in our community was limited to a few people that know how to play it. Today, golf has become an obsession by many. It's a clean sport, we're not bashing golf, but we're just trying to show how things change, you know, trends change. If you remember 10 or 15 years ago, maybe more, tennis in our community was a tremendous fad. Everybody was building tennis courts and lessons and practice, and then it died down for a while. Now already we see that the trend of tennis, for example, is coming back, and it's coming back stronger than ever. Part of this sport is obviously to take instruction and lessons, etc. Now, I don't have to remind you ladies of scandals that took place in our community, scandals of the nature that we're learning today, of sotah, but the worst adulterous situations that took place that are the ear cannot even tolerate to hear it. You cringe when you hear such thoughts of the immensity of the crime, of the avon, of the lack of shame, of the crudeness, of the selfishness, of the wickedness. Is there a rationale, and I could be off on this, is there a rationale that we could overlook such behavior in order to take tennis instruction? Is tennis instruction the most important thing in the world, that nothing is more important than it, that we're willing to even risk our marriages as a result of it, and risk our family lives as a result of it, and risk everything that we work in life in order to have a better serve or have a better backhand? And again, I'm not knocking the sport itself. I myself went to tennis camp for many years. So we're not against the sport. But to what extent? And therefore, for such behavior to take place in a community, that we could tolerate such instruction by people that are obviously not thinking in the lines that we're thinking in Torah. The dress of tennis in itself is not a modest dress. So all the more so, how careful do we have to be? Ladies, don't be naive. We have to be careful in general, but if a person already has a record, now you're talking about maybe make teshuvah. Can everybody make teshuvah? Can everybody repent? You know, there was a fellow, and you'll forgive my crude examples, there was a fellow that was a molester of children. And I'm proud to tell you, he made teshuvah. Are you going to let him come into your house? I'm going to take teshuvah. Teshuvah's between you and God. Get out of here. I'm not going to let you. You're going to let him babysit for your children? Why not? He made teshuvah. He said, Hatati, Abiti, Pashati. He'll show you a letter from the chief rabbi. He is now a recovered molesterer. I'm not interested. My children are my children. I get involved with such a thing. So even to such a thing to say, repent, teshuvah, that's, we're not judging. That's up to God. But from a point of, and it's not like you're going to a class. If you tell me, a rabbi has a good Gemara class, it's shiur. For what purpose? To learn tennis? Like I said, is tennis that important that we're willing to play craps? Or willing to shoot dice? It's unbelievable. And this message has to be spread to those people that don't understand it. And to discard it and say, nah, it's nothing, come on, Teal, you're being too black hat. If this is what became black hat in our community, Shema Yisrael, which means if this now becomes a new level, that if we're speaking against playing tennis with instruction of people that committed adultery and broke families, if that became now black hat, Shema Yisrael, where's our community going? Then tell me what's, that's it, there's no bar anymore. Then there's no, everything becomes permissible. So to discount it like that, especially our children, to have them exposed to such things at a young age, people, our children are not naive. They know the stories, they'll hear the stories, it'll come out, it's spoken. What type of message is a gift to our children? That a lady goes out of the house into these places over here and is willing to risk everything. It's not worth it, trust me. Because in 5 years, when tennis now finishes, and tennis becomes like a dinosaur, like it will become, and it will happen again, then what's going to happen? Where are you going to be standing? You're going to say you sacrificed your whole career of ethics for nothingness. Anybody going to become over here a tennis pro? And he's going to become, I don't know, the tennis players, I forgot them, Everett or et cetera, Billie Jean King, whatever the tennis players are, Navratilova, whatever they call them. No one's going to be a pro. You're not going to become a pro. It's a sport. Play in the backyard. You hit the ball around. You have a good time. Let's play. Go home. And you're going to have to become that expert where we become obsessed by such a thing. For what purpose? For the money? For the thing? For the kavod? So you're in a bake sale or in a day of tennis, so you win a tournament, big deal, it's not worth any of this over here. We're becoming crazy about, again, I don't want you to misunderstand me. I'm not telling you that you and your children should not have a place where they can let their energy out, a hobby, an outlet, very important. On the contrary, we tell the kids to play basketball once in a while. We tell them to get out, to do things, to breathe, to live. We're not saying, but to what extent? To what extent? Anything? So therefore, become wild, especially in the summer, where the attitude anyway in the summer is a loose attitude. You know, we're not living in Me'ah Shearim, ladies. We're not living in the Bnei Berak. So where we go in the summer, and the attitude anyway is a looser attitude, we have to be extra careful. Our God has to be much stronger on these things, not anything less. You'll forgive me again that we had to divulge our dirty laundry in public, but this is, I think, it's preventive medicine also for some. There's an interesting Gemara in Masechet Shabbat. The Gemara Shabbat says, Amar Rav Nachman, Titi Li, he says, they're going to give me reward. I'm going to get a lot of Olam Abba. Dekayim Shalosh Se'udot B'Shabbat. Because I was careful to eat Shalosh Se'udot. I had three meals with bread every Shabbat. So he was proud of him. I'm going to get reward because I eat three meals on Shabbat. Amar of Yehuda, Rav Yehuda says, Titi Li, he says, they're going to give me reward. Why? Dekayim T'ayun Tefillah. Because I used to pray every day with kavanah from the beginning of the prayer, from the beginning of the prayer to the end. Amar Rav Huna bered Rabbi Yohanan, Titi Li, they're going to give me reward. Delo sagina arba amot begilu yarosh, because I never walked four steps with my head uncovered. Another rabbi, Rav Sheshat, said they're going to give me reward because I never walked four steps without wearing my tefillin. Rav Nachman says they're going to give me reward because I never walked four steps without wearing a sissit. Abaye came along and said they're going to give me reward because anytime I saw a rabbi that finished an entire tractate of Talmud, of Gemara, I made a party for them. So Rav Steinemann, may live and be well, asked on this Gemara. He said, those are all nice things what these rabbis did. One rabbi was careful to always eat Seudat Shlishit, to wear a sissit, very nice. Another rabbi is making parties for people that are finishing Gemariot, all nice things. But why are they so special that they're boasting as if to say, well, I'm getting special reward. Like you didn't discover America. It's not the, like you tell me you saved people's lives. Tell me you learned the entire Talmud backwards and forwards. I mean, you're coming along and saying that you deserve special credit because you ate three meals or you prayed every day with Kavanah. Nothing earth-shattering over here. So says Rav Steinemann, the common denominator between all these things is that they were done consistently. It's a key. The rabbi's rule is that in Shamayim, you're not judged necessarily on how great the deed that you're involved in. The judgment in heaven is on how consistent you are in fulfilling it. The key is the consistency. Which means the rabbi said, I ate Seudat Shlishit, Hazak Baruch, big deal, we all do it. Yeah, but we do it, sometimes we do it, sometimes we miss it. So we're going to get reward, but we can't boast that this is our ticket. These rabbis were saying, when it comes to, let's say, wearing tzitzit, one rabbi could say, I never missed. Rabbi, that's not the biggest mitzvah, but now it is the biggest mitzvah. Because you always did it. Hakam said that you have to try to find something in your life, as small as it may be, and hold on to it. I only mention these ideas because Baruch Hashem, for the past 30 or 40 weeks, we've had a consistent situation, whether it's here in the class that we come to on Thursdays or other venues that you go listen to Torah and hear Musar or whatever it is. To go 10 weeks or 12 weeks and to make a break in the action, not only is it detrimental for a summer to go 10 or 12 weeks without Torah, but it dilutes everything that we did till now because it's not consistent. But if a lady can say, I don't know, I might not be the greatest wife or the greatest mother or the greatest religious person. One thing, I came to a class once a week. Finished. That's a ticket. That's consistent. Small, but it's key. It's indelible. It's there. There's a mark. And therefore, I have to remind you, ladies, that in the summer, your Torah careers must not end. There's a Gemara that says, in Ta'anit, listen to a story. In the city of Sura, there was a plague. God forbid, lo alechem. There was David, there was pestilence. B'shibbute de Rav, but in the neighborhood where Rav lived, lo havat de barta. There was no plague. Amazing thing. The whole city is being plagued. There's an epidemic. But where Rav lived in his little neighborhood, the epidemic did not hit. So what do you think everybody said?
What is zechut? We're living with Rav, the greatest rabbi, Sadiq, Hasid, his zechut. The plague didn't come.
So the Gemara says that they came to Rav in a dream, and they told him, it's not you. You're not the guy that staved off this plague. Who is it then? So what's what they said? They said, Mishumahu gabra, because there's a man living in the community, the Shayil Marav Zavila Likbura. He lends out his shovel. God forbid, if anybody needs a shovel at a time of a funeral, to dig a grave, whatever it is, he's the guy that they go to lend or borrow the shovel. Which means he had a gamach. What's a gamach? He had a certain free loaning program. It wasn't the most upbeat item that he's lending out. Not like he's lending out wedding gowns or something like that. But his thing was, he bought a shovel and he put a sign up, I'm the guy. Anybody needs a shovel, God forbid, in their time of need, come to me, I'm the guy, I'll lend you the shovel. So the Gemara says, in the zechut of that guy, we don't know how religious he was, we don't know what type of meat he ate, we don't know full of kavanah and praying, he definitely wasn't more religious than Rav. But the Gemara says, that was the guy that generated the zechut to save the whole town. Why? So says the rabbi, because it was something small, but it was consistent. This was his mitzvah finished, which means that his shovel, which means if they call him 2 o'clock in the morning, God forbid, there's a funeral tomorrow morning, we need the shovel. He didn't say, well, do me a favor, I'm tired now. No, it's my mitzvah. Which means he accepted upon himself, no matter what the circumstance, I'm the guy. It can be inconveniencing, it could be late, early. He could be away. He'd appoint somebody else. Make sure the shovel's got to go out. So because he did it time and time again, God says that mitzvah is so powerful that it can save an entire city. Ladies, I say protect yourselves. You can buy yourselves an insurance policy over here that can bring protection to yourselves, to your family, to our community. If you would continue at least maintaining the level of learning that you've been doing, God bless you all, this past year. The summer should not be an excuse to minimize your studying. Of course, it's a time to be a little more relaxed. There's no question about it. It's a time to as a diversion, to take your mind off of things a little in order to come back stronger. There's no doubt. My rabbis, before we used to go out on a trip, whether it was a winter vacation or Hanukkah, I had a rabbi that used to bring us into the office and used to give us words of encouragement before the trip. Now, the first time I was invited to such a talk, I thought that the rabbi was going to make us feel guilty. You know, tell us what you're going away for, it's no good. Like a typical speech that, they come up the whole trip before you went away, so therefore you don't want to go away anymore because the rabbi killed the whole trip. So I was waiting for that. And I would have been upset if I would have heard it. The rabbi said the contrary. He said, boys, you're going away. He says, the first thing I'm going to tell you, have a good time. Have a good time. What does the rabbi tell you to have a good time? It's haram to have a good time, not to have a good time. So he shocked us. He says, why am I telling you this? He said, if you're going away, the purpose is to relax, to ease your mind a little. So God willing, you'll come back after the trip. You'll be strong. You'll have peace of mind. You'll have clarity. You'll be able to learn much better. He says, God forbid you should come back from the trip like many people do, more tired than they were when they came, because they were out all night partying and drinking and sleeping and what? They came back haggard from a trip. Such a trip, it defeated its purpose. So he says, have a good time, relax, enjoy yourself, but know that there's a purpose to it. And therefore, we're not telling you that you should sit in the Bet Midrash the entire summer from the morning to the night. That being said, one still has to maintain the continuity and the momentum that has been built up. Because in religion, once you stop, it's like, God forbid, if a helicopter reaches a certain altitude and now they shut the propeller, so the helicopter doesn't cruise. It crashes, comes down. In religion, it's the same thing. to maintain a certain level, you constantly have to propel yourself. You constantly have to be moving, not to grow, just to maintain the same level. Gemara says, for every one day that you don't learn, God forbid you lose 2 days of growth. Our children that went to school for 150 days or 200 days, in the course of a sum of 75 days, without having them go to class, having them learn, having them open a book, so a whole year of education can be wiped out in 75 days of nothingness. Therefore, for our children also, we must see to it that they go to classes, that they, even minimal hour a day, something, Gemara, just to keep them afloat. I remember when we were young, in the summer, our parents forced us to go to a shul. Of course, we hated it. Who wants to go to class in the summer? We're kids. It doesn't matter, rabbi, not rabbi. A kid doesn't like to learn, not during the year, not during the summer. But they forced us. In Japan, they have school 12 months a year. Then you wonder, how come the Japanese people are so smart? Every kid, you know, he plays violin, they're smart, IQ 200. It's no secret. Because they're learning 12 months a year, there's no break. However, by us, there's constant interruption. From vacation to vacation. Now a 2.5 month vacation, Shammai says, devastating to a child's growth. And therefore, you not only have to maintain your own level, ladies, but you have to see to it that your children will go to class. And that's your responsibility. You know, a man is in work. He doesn't see what's going on. The kids come home from camp 4 o'clock. Your husband's still in Manhattan, wherever he is. It's out of his control. Of course, you can tell the kids in the morning, don't forget to go to class, but it's finished. His control is limited, but the lady's home. And therefore she has to impress upon her children to continue going to the class, to maintain it wherever they may be. I'll conclude with a Gemara in Masechet Chagigah. The Gemara in Masechet Chagigah says that at the end of the holidays, Pesach, on Shavuot, on Sukkot, there used to be a custom in the Beit HaMikdash where the Kohen, the Kohanim, they would lift the table. Listen to the story. The table that used to have the 12 loaves of bread on it, there used to be a table in the Beit HaMikdash, and there were 12 showbread, they called them, Lechem HaPanim. And there was a miracle about those breads. They would put them on the table on Shabbat and they would remain piping hot for the entire week. And there was no hot plate underneath them. There was no preservative to keep them fresh. But they remained fresh and hot. So as a bonus, after the holiday was over, the Kohanim would pick up the table and they'd bring it out as far as they could bring it out and show the people, Rabotai, look how much God loves you. And they would tell the people, Siluko kisiduro. The way we take it off the table piping hot, that's the same way we put it on. Or the way we put it on is the same way we took it off. Which, look at the miracle, it's hot, it's still hot. And everybody would say, oh, wow, what a miracle, unbelievable. Look at that, it's a week later and you see it out. So I once saw a rabbi ask a good question. What did you need to show the people that extra miracle? The Gemara tells us there were 10 daily miracles in the Beit HaMikdash, which means if you went to the temple on any given day, there were 10 open miracles that you were able to see. One of the miracles it says was, when they used to bring sacrifices, the smoke used to go straight up like a stick. It's outdoors. There's wind, there's storms, but the smoke straight up, unaffected by any climate or any winds. A miracle? They said if you went into the Beit HaMikdash to pray, everybody, no matter how crowded the Beit HaMikdash was, everybody had 6 feet around him to bow, to make Oseh Shalom. It's not a normal thing. If you draw it on a diagram, you see there's a certain amount of area, and you can figure out how many people could fit in this place, how many footage. But it was a miracle. No matter how many people were in the Beit HaMikdash, there was always room. So you saw an open miracle. And there was 8 more such miracles. So the rabbis asked, what do you need to show them this bonus miracle with the bread for? They were inspired enough. They saw enough things. They didn't need the 11th item. So the explanation was like this. The Kohanim were actually giving the people a lesson here. They were saying like this. Ladies and gentlemen, you came to the Beit HaMikdash for the holiday. You were here in Jerusalem for 7 days. We know how we feel when we come back from Jerusalem. We're hot, we're on fire. What are we living in America for? We should all live in Israel. It's so beautiful. The life, the Torah. You get inspired. But what happens 2 days after you get back? Already you start getting cooled off, America, Brooklyn, then you start thinking, oh, Israel would have paid the neck to live there, who wants to live in Israel? We become acclimated and then we forget everything. So the Kohanim needed to tell these people, Rabotai, now you're on fire. You just spent the week in Yerushalayim, don't cool down. Make sure to preserve that awakening. Make sure that you preserve that inspiration. How would they teach them that? Look at the bread. This bread is a week old. And it didn't cool down. It's still hot. It's still fresh. And therefore you're leaving now. You're flying home. You're going home. You're walking home. Remember the lesson of the showbread. That the trick is that it has to remain hot a week later. And therefore I tell you ladies the same thing. Now we're leaving for our vacation, so to speak. Not that Brooklyn is compared to the Beit HaMikdash, but for us, this is where we get our inspiration, this is where we get our elevation, and now we're going away from that. The key is that when we resume in September, that we still have the same level. That we can say this is the miracle of the Lechem HaPanim, that it's still hot, it's still motivated, not a week later. This is a greater challenge. 2 months later, that nobody should come. And now in your mind you think, I'm good. It doesn't work like that. It just happens where we just start falling and falling. Before we know it, what happened? So you have to be vigilant. They tell an example of a fox that was in the field and he saw the hunter coming. He said, I have one or two options. I could start running now. So, you know what, I'm too tired to run. I just woke up, I'm going to run. I'm too lazy to run. So you know what? I'll play dead. The guy will come, will see me dead. Maybe he'll just walk by. I'll sketch the hunter. So he plays dead. The hunter comes with his son. So his son said, wow, daddy, look at the tail of the fox. I wish I could have this tail. I want to hang it in my car. So the fox says to himself, all right, what's the worst? I said, I'll cut my tail. All right, I'll cut the tail, but I'm not going to die. I'm willing to sacrifice my tail, but they cut the tail. It's a fox, not a human being. So now the son tells the father, oh, daddy, look at the teeth. It's like ivory. If I would only have these ivory teeth, I could make a pocketbook. I could make who knows what, whatever he wants to make. So the fox is thinking, Zachilak is going to take my teeth now. But he says, you know what? Teeth, you can live without teeth. That's worth it. They take all his teeth out. All of a sudden, the father says, you know something? If we could skin this fox over here, we could make now a rug. So the fox is like, Eli, now he's, I got to get out of here. They're going to kill me. So by the time he gets up to go, they're right on top of him. It's too late. They shoot him dead. That's the way of the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara works very, very slow. It doesn't happen overnight. First, the Yetzer Hara, what are you... Relax. So you get involved in a bad environment. Nothing's going to happen to me. So I have to sacrifice this a little. So I'll give up my class. It's a big deal. It's not the worst thing. It's not life sustaining. So you give it up. Yes, says, oh, beautiful. We got them to concede this item. And now slowly we'll get them the next item. All of a sudden, you know what? This is not important. Is it worth it to make a fight over that? We'll give this up also. And all of a sudden you start conceding, and you start falling. And all of a sudden you realize, I have nothing left. It's too late now. And yes, it has you in the clutches. And therefore you have to be careful not to concede. You have to be careful to keep on growing. And Bezrat Hashem, the zechut that you ladies have generated by coming here will protect you and your families and our community throughout the summer. Amen.